TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ambassador Chas Freeman explains why Trump and Zelensky argued. Freeman speaks from 30 years of experience in diplomacy for the U.S., in China, the Middle East, and Europe. Just one day after the world-famous fight between Presidents Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office, on February 28, the podcaster Yotish Manmudiar asked Ambassador Chas Freeman the following questions. Why doesn't Zelensky want a ceasefire? What is the reason for U.S.-Russia normalization? And why are there divisions within Europe regarding Russia and NATO? Will the U.S. deep state survive? And are we watching a U.S. coup d'etat? Ambassador Chas Freeman is a retired American diplomat and writer. He served in the U.S. Foreign Service and the State and Defense Departments over the course of 30 years. Most notably, he worked as the main interpreter for Richard Nixon during his 1972 China visit and served as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1989 to 1992, where he dealt with the Gulf War. The Associated Press characterized Freeman as outspoken on issues including Israel, Iraq, and the War on Terror. In 2004, Freeman was among 27 retired diplomats and military commanders. They publicly said the administration of President George W. Bush did not understand the world and was unable to handle, in either style or substance, the responsibilities of global leadership. End quote. Chas Freeman was interviewed by Yotish Manmudiar. He and his colleagues are running the YouTube podcast channel India Global Left. Here are highlights from their 50-minute conversation.
Let me welcome ex-ambassador of the United States, Chas Freeman. Ambassador Freeman, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Yotish Man.
Zelensky seems to be not ready for a ceasefire.
Why does Zelensky not want a ceasefire? I think it's probably his own domestic politics in Ukraine. Why does Mr. Putin not want a ceasefire? Because his objective is a peace in Europe, and that cannot be achieved on the model of Korea with an armistice along a demilitarized zone or a ceasefire. And finally, Mr. Putin is advancing, not retreating along the line of battle. And that is always a position in which a ceasefire is not desirable. If this fighting goes on while the negotiations continue, then Ukraine is going to lose more territory, as well as a lot more people. So I don't think the Russian position is controlling here. That is, the Russians want a discussion of three issues: neutrality of Ukraine, no foreign forces in Ukraine that might threaten Russia. It's a perfectly understandable position. Protection for the Russian speakers in Ukraine, now through their incorporation into Russia, rather than under the Minsk Accords, which would have made them part of Ukraine with certain autonomous rights, culturally and linguistically. And finally, most important, he wants a discussion of new security architecture in Europe. That would reduce the perceived threat to his own country and in return reduce the perceived Russian threat to others. That is what this is about. You know, I hesitate to say that Mr. Trump, is more reasonable than Mr. Zelensky, because it's not at all clear to me that he understands completely what is going to be required to produce a peace in Ukraine. It can't be produced by a ceasefire. That has never been a real possibility. What disturbs Mr. Zelensky and others, of course, is the Trump administration's apparent recognition that a draft treaty was reached in March 2022, shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, at Istanbul, under the mediation of the Turks and the then Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. So basically, the starting position of the Russians and the Americans appears to be that treaty, that draft. And Mr. Zelensky was persuaded by Boris Johnson to repudiate that draft and not to go have the meeting with Mr. Putin that was scheduled to take place where the two of them would ratify the treaty. So I think he's been in a very hard place. I feel very sorry for Ukrainians. For the last 3 years, they've taken huge losses. Their country's been deindustrialized, depopulated. Their casualties have been enormous. They've lost territory, and they have no prospect of recovering from that. That is a very difficult position to be in, and it is one that the collective West placed Ukraine in. And Mr. Zelensky's great mistake was to agree with Boris Johnson speaking for the collective West.
I think that brings me to my next question. What do you make about some kind of normalization on U.S.-Russia relationship? Some people are saying that this normalization is part of U.S. foreign policy towards China. It's the sort of, you know, trying to divide Russia from China. Others are saying that it's not that. It's an understanding in the Oval Office that realist principle in international relations that recognizes that concerns of great powers within the international field have to be respected. How do you make sense of some kind of normalizations between the United States and Russia?
Well, I think such a normalization would be in the interest of both countries. I have to say that I think theories about some sort of grand strategy driving U.S. policy at present are really very questionable. Mr. Trump is not a geopolitical thinker. He's a businessman. He's trying to foreclose on Ukraine, basically as though it were some kind of derelict building. He's trying to foreclose on Gaza in the same way, and then treat the whole matter in the case of Gaza like a real estate development, and in the case of Ukraine, extorting rare earths and other natural resources. This is a very mercenary approach to foreign policy, quite the opposite of a geopolitical approach. And I want to note also that the reach for rare earths, whether it's in Ukraine or more plausibly in Greenland, you know, which is another objective of this presidency. So I don't think we should be surprised by the bullying tone and imperialist attitude of the American side in this meeting. The sad fact is that probably only 5% of the world's rare earths are in historical Ukraine, and almost all of them are now under the control of the Russians. This is really a fiction put in, I think, the president's mind by Lindsey Graham, who is prone to fanciful thinking. And so I think, there is a thinking on the part of some of Mr. Trump's subordinates about using Russia against China. I think this reflects a lack of understanding of the nature of the Russian relationship with China. And it also overlooks the events of the past two or more decades in U.S.-Russian relations, which are a heavy burden. You know, and in that regard, I think the Russians, like everyone else, have not failed to notice that Mr. Trump does not keep his promises. He signs treaties, for example, with Canada and Mexico about trade during his first administration, and then completely repudiates what he'd agreed to in his second coming. And the same is true of many, many other agreements. He does not apparently respect the North Atlantic Treaty, by which NATO is an alliance between Europeans and Americans, and also provides the United States with a sphere of influence in Europe. So we see our European allies now in a state of consternation not understanding how they are going to manage. They have been dependent on the United States for 80 years, 80 years, since 1945, the end of World War II, to maintain order on their continent. This has allowed them to avoid all sorts of difficult questions. I think, too, Mr. Trump stated in a cabinet meeting that the purpose of the European Union was, quote, to screw the United States, unquote. That is not my memory or that of the Europeans. The European Union was, in part, an American project to put Europe back on its feet and make it an independent actor aligned with the United States in world affairs. It was not intended to screw the United States. And that was not the European perspective.
I wanted to ask you about Europe a little bit more. We recently interviewed Ambassador Jose Zorrilla, and he outlined the divisions within Europe regarding Russia, you know, starting with the UK being extremely Russophobic and anti-Russia, to the concerns within the Nordic Baltic states. And then you have Germany, which is far more divided given all their economic interests. And then maybe like, you know, Spain, France, Italy, somewhere in the middle, who like kind of cares, but also kind of doesn't care.
What is happening in Germany now with this coalition government formation is really very important. And I don't think, even if Alternative for Deutschland is excluded from the government this time, that it can be ignored. And it is clearly in favor of reopening the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, reaching out to Russia economically and so forth. And I'll just conclude with an obvious further point. And Europe is divided in many ways, not just on issues with Russia. The Spanish, for example, have a very different position on Palestine and Israel than the Germans do. Orban, the leader of Hungary, recognizes the need for Hungary to have a cordial relationship with Russia and acts accordingly. And here we come to a very interesting point, and that is the only countries that have put forward proposals for peace have been China, India, South Africa, Hungary, Brazil. Not a single European EU core member has put forward a plan. The United States has not put forward a plan. So when the Europeans complain about being excluded from the meeting in Riyadh between the American Secretary of State and others and the Russian counterpart, I think they really don't have much of a leg to stand on. Because what do they stand for? They had a meeting in Paris of a rump group, not the entire EU, those most actively engaged. British were included, even though they're not part of the EU. Macron convened this. What did they talk about? They spent 3.5 hours talking about an idea that is absolutely infeasible, which is a military peacekeeping force in Ukraine. This will never be accepted by the Russians. The whole reason they went to war was to prevent a NATO presence in Ukraine. They didn't talk about what they should have talked about, which is political arrangements in Europe that could provide a guarantee to Ukraine or whatever remains of it when the war is over. They could have raised the model of the Austrian State Treaty of 1955. They did not. And therefore, there are the three issues the Russians put on the table consistently from 1994 on, and which culminated in an ultimatum in December 2021. Those three issues are still the issues to be discussed. Number one, a neutral Ukraine with no hostile foreign forces on its territory. Number two, protection of minorities, especially the Russian minority, in Ukraine. Now the Russians insist on keeping the four oblasts they have conquered in whole or in part in order to protect those Russian speakers. And of course, Crimea, which is also 75% Russian speaking. And the final and largest issue is the question of arrangements for peace in Europe. something that is a cooperative security arrangement that is not a confrontation of military blocs, you know, this is going to have to be discussed. It's going to be incredibly difficult if Europeans don't get their act together. I have been reminded of the history of my own country, the United States of America, when we first convinced the British at the point of a gun that we should be independent, we formed Articles of Confederation. That was our first constitution. It did not work. It was too loose. 13 different states could not reach agreement. And it was replaced in 1787 by a full revision of the current constitution. That enabled decisions to be taken at the center that couldn't be taken during the period of the Articles of Confederation. So Europeans have a problem. If they can't come up with a structure that enables them to produce clear decisions and bind all their members to them, then they are going to continue to be much less than the sum of the parts. And they need to become more than the sum of the parts. And I would say, from the point of view of most countries in the world, and I would include myself, although not the majority of Americans, an independent, prosperous, active Europe as part of a multinodal order would be a very good thing. It would be a counter to the Russians. It would be a counter, a balancer, and a counter to us. It would be a counter to India, Brazil, the other great powers that are emerging, Indonesia, Japan coming back. And this would be a much more intelligent design for world order than hegemony or warfare between great powers.
Part of the problem, it seems to me, with Europe is the very idea of European Union that worked very well in the post-war reconstruction phase, beginning as like coal iron cartel, and then, you know, having common manufacturing markets, eventually, you know, upgrading into custom union, monetary union, and so on, have really fallen behind during the so-called neoliberal years. And, you know, the excitement about European Union, of course, like people still like to move freely, you know, tourism, some form of common labor market, but the idea of European Union has been so corrupted. Then we can talk about the security.
Well, a good deal of that problem derives from the fact that the approach of the United States to Europe has been to ask Europe to do things, but then to say under our, in quietly, well, if you don't do those things, we'll do them for you. So, you know, as I said earlier, for 80 years, we have been responsible for sustaining the European order. The EU is in some respects an American project. And progress on it has completely halted because there was no incentive, no disincentive. You know, Europeans were not under any pressure to do anything. Mr. Trump raised the question of they're making greater contributions to NATO. By the way, NATO doesn't have a budget. The contributions are all national. So Mr. Trump's formula is not correct. But the contributions to NATO by countries like Poland now are very substantial. Those of those farther away from Ukraine are much less. But the fact is that the incentive to reach a 2% target was undermined constantly by the United States saying, well, if you won't do that, we'll do it, you know, for you. And, you know, we really should, after the end of the Cold War, if we didn't disband NATO, we should have restructured it. And we should have recognized that the Russian threat was gone. Instead, we acted in such a way as to resurrect the Russian threat by expanding NATO militarily to the east. And I go back to the point that that meeting at Paris, I gather there's to be another one before long, but the meeting in Paris that Macron convened, you know, was sort of typified what is the problem. He talked about the need for Europeans to develop a European-wide military-industrial complex, procurement policies that are European-wide, pan-European. And then he said, so you should buy the Leclerc tank. He didn't say, France will buy Leopard tanks from Germany. In a way, despite recognizing the need, he and other Europeans continue to behave in ways that that serve their narrow national interests rather than the interests of all. And now, of course, Europeans, since the United States seems to be walking away from them, I mean, there was a very clear message sent at the Munich Security Conference, we are turning to the Pacific. We are going away from the Atlantic. You are on your own. You're going to have to come up with your own way of ordering your continent and defending it, your interests. That was very clear. And now they are talking, we'll say, well, where does China come in on this? What do we do about China? You know, maybe China's for the United States, China may not be a balancer for Russia, but it could be for Europe. As I said, the geopolitical flux has seldom been this large.
I wanted to ask you about the U.S. so-called deep state. There has been a long-standing idea that the deep state in the U.S. is very powerful in terms of foreign relationship, and that's what leads to some kind of continuity in foreign policy. But it seems to me that now, at the wake of Blitzkrieg from the top, that deep state, whether it's the military-industrial complex or, you know, the national security apparatus, CIA, and so on, they are not in the picture. They're helpless or whatever. How permanent do you think these changes in U.S. foreign policy would be?
Well, first of all, the concept of the deep state, that is a translation from Turkish. That was a situation in Turkey that governments came and went, but the military dominated the society. That was called the deep state, the national security state in Turkey. I don't think it's exactly a comparable situation to the United States at all. Certainly there is a bureaucracy. There are institutions that provide continuity during government changes, usually. What is happening now is not the dismantlement of the deep state. It is the dismantlement of the state itself. And this is in part a classic coup d'etat operation. If you want to run a coup d'etat, there's actually a textbook on this, which Ed Lutwak wrote. If you want to run a coup d'etat, the first thing you do is dismiss all the senior officers in the security establishment, in this case, even down to the uniformed military, the CIA, the FBI, and you put your own loyal henchmen in there. And you conduct a purge of the existing government. You know, you shoot some people, you send others off to the farm or whatever. And all of this is happening. It's exactly a description of what is going on. So is this really aimed at the deep state, or is it, I think it's sort of a version of the Cultural Revolution in China. The Red Guards, just were told to bombard the headquarters and destroy the administrative state and so forth. And, Elon Musk's digital delinquents are doing that now.
We perhaps don't have the street mobilization. It's more of people from top like Elon Musk.
Well, Mao Zedong set off the Cultural Revolution. He was the one who destroyed his own government.
There were the Red Guards had massive street mobilizations, like in factories.
It was a different context. This is technology oriented,
right?
Not
factory, yes.
But if you look at it, Musk has, who's not, nobody elected Musk, Musk has seized control of the payment system in the treasury. That is pretty damn central to any state's functioning. Leave aside the decimation of leadership in other organizations. I think our republic is in the process of being demolished. The corruption is evident. The Supreme Court has no legitimacy in the minds of most people. It represents a particular partisan ideology. Some members of it are openly corrupt.
And a lot of these changes were done in the first tenure of the Trump administration.
Right, but I don't want to, you know, point fingers and allocate blame. There's plenty to go around on. The second thing, the Congress has defaulted on all its responsibilities. It does not exercise effective oversight. It grandstands a lot, but does nothing. It doesn't even pass a budget most of the time. We've had government shutdowns. And finally, the executive branch is somewhere between ignorance and insanity at the top at the moment. Very unpredictable and very powerful. So this is the end of the Republic. And what follows it, I don't know. I mean, I will say one thing, you know, again, the example of China or India or another great civilizational state. We are a sort of civilizational state. And the state can collapse. The geography isn't going to change. We're still going to have a superabundance of good agricultural land, water, a very talented group of citizens of many, many backgrounds, two wide oceans. And while we're working on making enemies of Canada and Mexico, I don't think they will fall into that trap. I find it unbelievable that we are engaged in bullying everybody, including the European Union. Britain, I guess, got off scot-free, and I think Mr. Starmer heaved a sigh of relief as he left that there were no sanctions put on the UK. But, you know, it could happen tomorrow. We don't know.
It could happen tomorrow. We don't know. This interview of retired Ambassador Chas Freeman was recorded one day after the Trump-Zelensky fight that took place in the Oval Office on Friday, February 28, 2025. Ambassador Chas Freeman is a retired American diplomat and writer. He speaks from 30 years of experience, having served in the U.S. Foreign Service and the State and Defense Departments. And the title and author of the book he just referenced is Coup d'etat by Edward N. Lutwak. That's Lutwak. You heard excerpts from a 50-minute long interview by Yotishman Mudiyar, held on March 1st, 2025. Yotishman and his colleagues are running the YouTube podcast channel India Global Left. You can find the full interview on YouTube under the title Ambassador Chas Freeman Explains Why Trump and Zelensky Argued. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.